The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, December 27th, the Friend Zone edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I am the editorial director of Slate Podcasts, and I'm the father of Eliza, age 8, and also Leo, who is 4.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, a podcaster and journalist in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 17, Teddy, who is older than 15 and a half, and my stepdaughter Lily, who is 18.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and podcaster in Oakland, California, and I'm the father to Georgia, who is 13, and Ezra, who is 15.
Today on our show, we're going to be talking about a feature that ran in the Washington Post about growing up as a boy in this complicated time and how to raise boys to be good men. We're also going to take a question from a listener who has 2 children, one of whom is a lot chiller than the other. Plus, as always, we'll have triumphs and fails. We'll make recommendations. And on Slate Plus, Carvel is going to tell the story of a favorite family holiday tradition. But let's start with triumphs and fails. Carvel, you got a triumph or a fail?
I have a fail, which is the same fail that I have intermittently, which is I work too much and then thusly make terrible mistakes with my kids that stress them out. And I had a we're at year end, and being that it's the year end, it's like a lot of stuff has sort of come due at the same time, and I've taken on a lot of deadlines and projects at the end of the year. And so, you know, I did like this, like I did a bunch of pieces, and then I had in addition to the weekly column and the podcast, and it's like, it's been a lot through the months of November and December. And I had a big long piece due for the New York Times Magazine, which is coming out in January. And I had to get this big 4,500 word draft in, and it involved flying all over the place and interviewing all these people and going to all these different viewings of things, and it was a lot. So I was like missing the kids and not here this week, and I can't take you to the thing because I'm out of town this week, and but I'll be back, and I promise. And so but I was like, you guys just got to hold on, because I'm gonna finish the file this draft on like Monday basically of this week, and then I don't have to write anything for like the rest of the year. I don't have to write anything for the rest of the year. And so Monday came, and I was working on this draft, and it ended up just going late. And I did something that I do periodically, maybe a couple times a year, which is I had to pull an all-nighter to get this thing finished. So, but once I got it done, it's going to be in edits for a while, and then secondary interviews, all that stuff will be later, and so I'll be able to kind of chill. So I was supposed to wake up. I went to bed at 6 a.m. because I wrote the piece until like 4, and then I had to do my Slate column. And I did my Slate column until like 6. And then I went to sleep. And I was like, this is great. I'm going to sleep for just an hour, catch some shut-eye. Then I'm going to wake up at 7. I'm going to go take Georgia to school. And then after that, I'm going to come home. And I had one more appointment. Then I come home and sleep through the day and like get right. And so, of course, my alarm did not go off at 7:30, or it went off, but at a volume so low that I legitimately slept through it. I woke up at 8:30 a.m. to like 3 phone calls from Georgia, 2 texts from Joe. And Joe was like super understanding. She's like, I just want to make sure you're okay. I know that you were probably working an all-nighter. So I just went ahead and took Georgia to school. But, you know, just let me know that you're alive, because I'm worried. And so I talked to her. But the problem is that Georgia and I have been starting to butt heads over this thing about time, because she is really, really, like, it doesn't matter what the situation is. It could be something as chill as like, hey, we're going to go, like, I don't know, have ice cream, or we're going to go to the mall or whatever. I'd be like, yeah, okay, I'll pick you up from the bookstore at 1, around 1. I'll be like, I'll do it around 1. I have to finish this thing, and then I'll be there around 1. So then at 12:58, she'll call me and be like, are you on your way? And I'm like, I mean, not yet. I mean, I'll be there like around 1, between 1 and 1:15. So I'll get there at 1:10, and she'll be like, you said you'd be here at 1. And I'm like, no, I said I'd be here around 1 because I'm working and finishing this thing. This has been like an ongoing thing between us. And it's really our main point of contention right now, is that she views every time you mention a single number, she becomes fixated on things happening exactly at that time. And if it's a minute late, then it's late, and that's a problem, and it needs to be addressed. And I'm just like, look, I'm trying to do all this stuff. I'm working all these jobs. I'm like trying to parent. I'm trying to, you know, I'm navigating multiple things. I'm doing my best. I'll be there around 1 or between 1 and 1:15. And so just chill. And so the last time that when we went for the Christmas tree thing, that's what happened. I told her I'd be there around 1. I woke up at 7 a.m. on that Sunday morning. I wrote until literally 12:55. Then I headed over there and I got there like 1:10. And she was like mad at me. And we finally had it out. And Joe a little bit sort of like refereed kind of, but like also was like trying to keep out of it because she recognizes it's between us. And so it's been a source of contention between us. I take it personally because I feel like on the one level, I'm mad at her because I'm like, I'm doing all this work for you. This is to pay for your college so that you eat, so that you have clothes. But then also I'm like, she's right. I'm not great at managing time. And Ezra lets it slide, but she doesn't. And I feel bad about that. And so not being able to make it on Tuesday morning to take her to school has really been bothering me. And we talked about it. I apologized. She was actually like, it's fine. Like, it happens to me sometimes. I sleep through my alarm and, you know. But I just, it's like I felt like I really failed her because I'm really trying to, like, meet her where she's at, even though it's not where I'm at. Because I love her and I, like, want her to, like, you know, I just, like, want to respect whatever her thing is, even though I find it a little bit annoying. So that's my fail.
That's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Rebecca? Triumph or fail?
I've got a triumph that I didn't want to talk about in the previous show because I was regaling you with a tale of my broken leg. But the day after I broke my leg, my first outing after breaking my leg was to my kids' school concert, their winter concert, which was so awesome because there were so many Lavoie boy star moments, which was super cool. And I'm not saying this like lightly because, you know, this is a small school. There's only one music teacher. She does all of these things. And I would think it would be really horrible if every single concert like starred my kids and only my kids, because there's lots of really talented kids who go to this tiny high school. And I'm just so grateful that they have this flourishing arts program. And it's a very like sports centric school, but, you know, there's just wonderful teacher and she's just so great. So I got to go to this concert and the coolest thing about it, and it warmed my heart and like multiple people came up to me afterwards and were talking about it, was Teddy sang a beautiful solo, which is like something that not a lot of people know that he can do. So you get to do that. But then in the jazz band part of the performance, there was like a drum solo that Henry did, followed by a bass solo that Teddy did. So, of course, during the bass solo, like just Henry was playing because, you know, it's accompanied by a drummer. And so for like a solid like 16 bars of like every parent's dream, my two huge boys who refused to play together at home because Teddy's always on the computer and Henry is just like sick of asking his brother if he'll jam with him or whatever. We're playing together on stage, like in front of all these people. And it was so awesome. And I was crying and Kevin was crying and like their music teacher came up to me afterwards and she was crying. It was just really beautiful and something to really celebrate. And one of the main bright spots of this season of hobbling that I am enjoying right now. So I wanted to tell you about it. So thank you for listening.
That sounds good. I have a birthday party fail. I went with Leo to one of his friend's 5th birthdays recently. And it was, they had various music related activities. It was like a music place. And one of the things, they had a dance party at the end. And for a couple of the songs, they would like turn off the lights and they gave all the kids glow sticks. And they're like, it's like dance in the dark. Or it looked like a, like 4-year-olds or 5-year-olds in a like club or whatever. And they were playing, you know, they were playing the, what you would expect them to play, songs from the Trolls, the movie soundtrack or whatever. And there all these kids are running around and I'm watching Leo and he's got an orange glow stick and he's super happy about it and he's into it. And like, they're not really dancing, you know, they're running and they're jumping and then some of them are like kind of pushing and shoving. And there was a boy who like his game was to like push Leo and like almost knock him over, sometimes knock him over. And I was watching this and like, I definitely don't want to be the dad who's like, you just pushed my son. That's, you're being, you know what I mean? And like, it, like, so I'm watching it closely as you can watch like 25, like 4-year-olds dancing around with the lights out. I'm watching to try to get a read on the situation. Like, is this a fun game or has it like stopped being fun? And if it stopped being fun, has it become scary to the point where I should intervene or, you know what I mean? It's a judgment call all the time. And it looks to me like it's fun. I feel like I know Leo and can sort of read when he's upset. He's not a guy who, like, hides it when he's upset with the situation. And it seems like he's, like, getting up and getting back into it and then, like, then pushing more pushing. But it just seems like it's fine. And the other kid's dad, whom I know from the school, I can identify him as the other kid's dad, is also watching what's going on. His son is pushing another guy, and is it fun or not? And I see him, like, sort of look at me, and he's about to go in to, like, intervene and break up the situation. And I kind of felt like, no, let's let this play out. Let's make this a, like, give the kids a little more rope kind of situation. And I sort of looked at him, and I was like, I think it's okay. I put up my hand in the gesture of, like, no, it's all right. And he, like, and we were like, yeah, okay. And I felt like me and this other dad are now on the same page, and we're being good, like, non-helicopter parents or whatever. And so I thought we were at a point where, okay, we are agreed on the best way to handle this situation. It's not as though then the kid shoved Leo and he fell down and broke his jaw, because that didn't happen. But afterwards, the dance party finished and he came up and he sat down on my lap and he was like, that guy was pushing me. And I was like, yeah, was it a fun game or did it hurt? And he was like, yeah, it was bad. I didn't like it. It hurt and it was scary. And I felt bad. I had misread the situation. I mean, you know, he's fine. Like, it wasn't like then that night in bed he was crying and asking, why did that kid push me? But it was definitely like I thought it was fun and it wasn't fun. So sorry, Leo. I left you to get pushed at the dance party. I feel bad about
that. Well, the good news is someday when he goes to a real rave and actually gets pushed, he'll be prepared. He's already experienced it. It won't be new.
But at a rave, wouldn't it be more like sort of gently stroked and caressed? He's definitely prepared for that. That's the kind of rave he would really like.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we move on, let's do the business. First of all, if you have a question that you want to ask us that we could answer on this show, you can call us 424-255-7833 or momanddad@slate.com. If you're not a member of the Facebook group yet, you should join. Go to Facebook, search for Slate Parenting. Lots of other parents there talking about the show, sharing triumphs and fails, asking for advice, and quite often getting it. On Slate Plus today, Carvel is going to share the story of a favorite holiday tradition. If you want to hear that segment and another like it every week, you should be a member of Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/momanddadplus right now. It's just $35 for your first year. It helps us make the show, and it gets you an extended ad-free edition of this podcast and your other favorite Slate podcast every single week. It's a good thing. Check it out. slate.com/momanddadplus. Okay, back to the show. Following on from what we were saying before the break about pushing and shoving and caressing and the different ways in which boys might express their emotions, there was a good and interesting series in the Washington Post recently. It's called Being a Boy. It had three different articles about raising boys today and being boys today. There's one about an 8-year-old and one about boys in puberty and one about teenage boys, older teenagers, all about dealing with the sort of greater awareness nowadays of coercion, culpability, and consent, to use a phrase from the head of one of these stories, but just about the propensity for male misbehavior and toxic masculinity. And the three of us were talking about this a little bit over the week. We found these stories interesting, but since I'm the one who is not raising a teenager, it was hard for me really to imagine how these concerns will play out in my parenting life because, you know, Leo is 4 and he's adorable. He's just like, he's the sweetest little guy. There's no way he would ever hurt anybody except through clumsiness. And like, I, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's a good guy. He's my good, sweet, dear little boy. And it made me wonder, like, well, what is this going to be like? What happens when he gets closer to being a man? And I wonder how you guys think about this stuff. And it seemed like it would be a good thing for us to talk about. Maybe one of you could tell me a little bit about how you think about this in being a parent to your boys.
That sentence you said about Leo never hurting anyone unless he's being clumsy, that's the one that strikes me because that's the guiding thing. I think that a lot of the hurt that boys and men inflict upon the world is sort of can be compared to clumsiness in this particular way, in that it's like it comes as the like natural consequence of lack of intention. Like the default setting for everything is for like masculinity to be harmful and toxic in a lot of ways. A lot of people don't like that. I actually just did a Karen Feeding column where I said something similar and I was reading the comments and people were like, blah, 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 PC culture, so on and so forth. And like millennials, which I'm like, yo, I'm like really old. I'm like 44 years old and I'm not a millennial. I mean, I believe that because I've been a man for a really fucking long time and I've seen a lot of shit go down. And my conclusion, and I'm not an idiot and I've been around for a while. And so my conclusion after 44 years of watching boys operate in the world is that the default setting for the way things go is that if not interrupted and pointed otherwise, then the default movement for masculinity is to like be harmful and toxic in a lot of ways. It's just the way it is. And so I don't think you have to actively be a mean or hurtful person in order to cause harm. And I think that you have to actively work against it in order to disrupt that. That has been my experience. And that's I think is what I try to like pass on to my kids. And that's important to both of them. Although I know today we're talking about the boys. I think for Georgia, a lot of it is about, I was just saying on Twitter the other day that one of my mantras to Georgia is the boys around you are learning stupid things and they're behaving stupidly as a result, because like she constantly needs that interpretation. Because she comes home and's like, the boy said this and this boy said this. And in my, you know, like biology class, this boy did this and the boys at lunch were doing this. And I have to constantly remind her, like, those kids are learning terrible things and they're behaving terribly as a result. Not that they are terrible, but that they're learning shitty things. And so so that is where I come from with that. It's not that my son is bad and he's going to go hurt people. It's that if we don't collectively work against it, his default position is going to cause some harm. And so that's kind of where I wanted to start talking about it. Like, and so I try to disrupt that by like pointing out the default ways in which that is, the way that like women are portrayed in like media, the way that certain ideas that are taken for granted among boys that are actually toxic and problematic. We had this whole thing about the friend zone, quote unquote, the friend zone. And that's been an ongoing thing. And he's having such a hard time seeing how that concept can be problematic. He's like, but if you want to hook up with someone and they don't want to hook up with you, they just want to be your friends, aren't you in the friend zone? And I was like, you know, and then we're having this going back and forth between like, yes, I understand that that is a factual thing, but the framing of it makes it sound as though they're doing something bad to you by not wanting to be intimate with you. And that is a situation you only experience with girls, or that topic is only applied to girls because the underneath assumption is that the purpose of girls is to like fulfill our sexual and romantic interest. And if they fail to do that, then like they are failing us in some way. And that's a problematic concept. But these are deep and layered things. And it takes so long to discuss them, explain them, argue over them, convince him. And so many times, because Ezra was super argumentative, so many times I will say something and he'll argue and argue it. And then he'll tell me that later, he, like 3 weeks later, he was at school arguing my position to kids in his school. And just like, you know, kind of like when I talked about last week, the show where I talked about him learning how to cut down the Christmas tree, I've watched him just learn, not on his own, but learn over time things that I thought he would never learn. He has this friend at school that I think is kind of like a MRA. He's a little bit like a men's rights advocate. I'm not going to say his name, but for years, Ezra would come home and be like, oh, I was talking with so-and-so today, and he said this, and I was talking to so-and-so today, and he said he was reading on the internet that the pay gap is actually not really a thing, and here's why. You know, and I'm like, "You, dude, this friend of yours is actually like kind of shady, and here's why." And Ezra would argue with me, no, I think you're looking too much into it. Well, Dad, you're just being too like hardcore. Well, Dad, this, you know, but like just recently he came to me and was like, wow, you know, I was noticing, I was talking to him and I was realizing, Dad, he's kind of an asshole. And I'm like, yeah, I've been telling you that for a few years, but it just took him a while to see that himself. And so I think that we have to be active and consistent about working on those things. And that means, of course, we have to work on them within ourselves. And that's how I, as a dad, try and work through it. And I think that if you talk to Jo, she has a whole different set of ways that she tries to address it. But I do think it does require addressing. Just being a good parent and raising a nice kid isn't going to be enough because the rest of the world is involved too. What do you guys think?
I agree with you. I mean, the thing is, this is what the direction that our like email conversation about this went in. There is no parent in the world who thinks that their kid could grow up to be, you know, a rapist, you know, or even a bystander to a rape. I mean, everybody right. thinks that their kid would never. And if that were true, that would be wonderful. But it isn't right. true. And so right. the proactiveness with which you have to, not just around consent. I mean, consent is like the outer layer of the onion of this conversation. And we yes, talked about that totally. When my kids were very young. I mean, I started talking to Henry about issues around consent and the behavior of his friends when he was like in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, and framing it like you might be in a situation where you see a girl that's is uncomfortable because a boy is talking to her a certain way, and it is your job to make sure your friend knows that you are not okay with it, not just like in that she's not okay with it and she shouldn't be, but that you are not okay with it. Like, we've had these conversations since they were super young. But I think the thing, I mean, and I think we talked also on the show about a year or a little more ago about that, talk about those men's rights activists, that group of boys that cropped up in the kids' right. school against, they created that Man Up Facebook group, because I mean, Instagram page, because there was a Girl Up one and they were posting all the super sexist stuff. And I outed them. Like, I was very comfortable, like in my social accounts, taking screenshots of their stuff, sharing it with other parents, sharing it with the school, and showing my kids that, like, whatever boundaries they think should be around sexist behavior or sexist behavior framed as jokes, that it's not funny. It is, in fact, like serious as a fucking heart attack. And like, you know, if it takes, you know, your mom embarrassing these boys, like, I don't give a shit. Like, that's who better to do it than your mom, right? Like, I'm not going to play that game with this stuff. But even like in small ways, I mean, I can think of so many times where, you know, the boys will be, you know, talking, or Kevin and I maybe will be having like a spat. And, you know, I remember once a couple years ago, I was arguing with Kevin about something. It was not major. It wasn't even really an argument. It was just sort of like a back and forth. And he said, oh, he's like, you're being so strident right now. And I was like, okay, let's just hit pause. And let's talk about that word, shall we? And how it's like, you know, systematically and uniquely applied to women in these situations. And for this reason, and this reason, this reason. I do that all the time, rhetorically, in our conversations at home. Like, I will interrupt people in the middle of a sentence and tell them why they shouldn't use, and not just with gender stuff, also with, you know, race stuff and cultural insensitivity. You know, I'll do that all the time, but like, it is a proactive process. And when you do get to that point where you even like get a hint that your kids are then arguing your points in the world, like, that's actually how it's done. Like, that's where the parenting is. You know, it's like, if you are we talk all the time about how it's bad to indoctrinate your kids into making them believe the things that you believe just because you believe them. They should believe them. This is different. This is not belief. This is right versus wrong. And it is completely okay to indoctrinate your kids on the side of right. It is completely okay to tell them that being sexist is wrong and to do it every single day, that being a misogynist is wrong, that a certain word has sexist or misogynistic connotations, that, you know, the fact that two boys wanted to run for prom king and queen because they thought it would be funny and, you know, they didn't understand, like, why a joke wasn't funny, to tell them why that's wrong, how it could hurt people, how, like, only two boys would feel like they would have the privilege to, like, two straight boys might feel like they had the privilege to sort of challenge the school that way, not for fighting for people's rights, but just because they thought it was funny. Like, these are conversations we have at my house all the time. And it has to be shameless and it has to be constant. And I'll just finally say this, like, the amount of times my kids have seen me stand up to sexism, not just sexism, you know, in like the casual conversations, but when I come home and talk about things that happen at work, or when I talk about sort of, you know, practices out there in the world, or things I see on social media, or times when I feel like, as a woman, especially in the podcasting world, you know, the opportunities that I don't get, that I see, you know, less successful, less talented men get. I talk about this stuff all the time. Like, I want to make it part of the discourse, and I do it without shame. And I like to think it's making a difference. I mean, I think the only test of that is to sort of hear your own kids' rhetoric. But I think it's okay to just know that you're right and indoctrinate your kids in also being right. I think you have to be relentless about it.
All right, I have one more question about this, which comes out of Carvel's reference to the concept of the friend zone. For the listeners out there who are not extraordinarily online, the friend zone is a piece of jargon that was made up by so-called pickup artists, people who publish guides on, like, how to seduce women or whatever. And part of their, like, seducing women strategic thinking bit is, like, well, if you talk to her in a way that's not sufficiently, like, masculine or alpha or whatever, then she's liable to put you in the friend zone, and then you're her friend. And when you're in the friend zone, then she's never going to want to have sex with you or be in a romantic relationship with you. And so part of the strategy involves avoiding the friend zone. And so it's bound up with this just completely loathsome and abhorrent set of discourse and practices. And like, yes, if a person talks about being in the friend zone, you know, obviously it's spread now from that group into more casual conversation. But so, yes, I can understand why, like, if Ezra comes home and is talking about being put in the friend zone, then you want to make sure he understands exactly what the ramifications of using that kind of language are and how fucked up all of that is. At the same time, the concept of the friend zone, like, the reason it spread and the reason that a kid like Ezra might want to use it and the reason that, like, it feels to some boys as though it describes something is that it connects to an experience of, like, male sexual loneliness and male romantic loneliness, right? It connects to a sort of wish to have someone love you and a wish to have sex, and neither of which is in and of themselves like a toxic wish, both of which are indeed sort of universal and basically healthy. Wanting to love and be loved and to engage in sex with somebody are completely healthy things. And I wonder if, in addition to teaching boys about the things that they might do that are harmful or the practices that they might perpetuate that are harmful, if there's stuff to teach them around how to assuage their own needs and their own loneliness in non-harmful ways. Like, what's the affirmative way to teach boys to behave that actually addresses some of that stuff?
Yeah, well, I think that there are a variety of, I mean, I think that there's so much layered in what you just said. And I think this is one of the reasons why collectively the public discussion of these concepts is, to put it generously, is rocky. Because there are seemingly, at first blush, arguments to be made in all kinds of ways. Like the argument you just made, I think, makes sense to a certain extent. And some of the nuance that gets missed, I think, there is the problem isn't that if you cast the notion of the friend zone, or even the use of it, of the phrase, a couple of things. One is that it's not really about the use of the word itself or the language itself. And I think that's something that people have a hard time understanding about language. It's that language literally does reinforce ideas and hierarchy. That's not a theoretical thing. That's a thing that actually happens. If we say things a certain way, we tend to think of them a certain way. And so if you say that there is this unwanted, unhappy zone that a person has put you in, because no one ever talks about going into the friend zone. No one ever talks about willingly going into the friend zone because they want to be a good fucking friend. That's not how that term is used. That term is used as though someone has put you there against your will, like it's a fucking penalty box. And it's never not used that way. And so it's not just about the words. It's about the meaning behind the words, because that meaning is real. And I think sometimes we forget that. So people will be like, oh, you can't fucking police language. You can't make it all about language. But it's like language actually does manage our hierarchies and views of the world. And so it's not just the language. It's the meaning. The second thing I would say is that I think that casting it as that, I think that you're right that it that there isn't a feeling of loneliness that any human being feels, man, woman, whomever, and that wanting to be intimate with someone and have love and not being able to does feel frustrating and is hurtful. And we've all experienced that, some more than others. I know that that was the primary experience I had of growing up, I would say, until a certain point in my life in which that changed. But when I was growing up, it really felt like I was, you know, I just felt super duper fucking lonely and no one loved me and no one liked me and no one had crushes on me and all that. And I think that is like a real thing. But I also think that the thing about the friend zone idea is that it suggests that other people are doing something wrong to you because you have that feeling. And so that gets to my – and that's a really important fucking distinction to make. Just because you have a feeling doesn't mean someone is doing something wrong. And I think that's like the that's the main problem when we talk about toxic masculinity, and the thing that ultimately leads to these abuses of power like sexual assault, is that underlying that belief is a belief that a person is doing something wrong to you by denying you the thing that you naturally and rightfully want, and that therefore you are justified in overriding or pushing past that person's will or boundaries. And so I think to answer your question, Gabe, one of the affirmative things that we get to do with our kids is that we get to help them see the distinction between having a feeling and being a victim of someone else's behavior, that they aren't the same thing all the time. There are places where they are the same thing, but there are places where they're not. And part of our job is, as parents, is to help our kids know the difference. So, of course, Ezra feels, I'm sure, all kinds of feelings of frustration and loneliness and sadness and romantic and sexual frustration, et cetera. And so what I get to do as a parent is I get to model for him and talk with him and be honest with him about how I navigate through the world with those feelings, what I do with them. And none of the stuff that I do with them involves looking at other people, especially a whole class of people like women, en masse and saying they're the reason why I have this feeling. I think
it's
that's an
fault.
Important distinction to make.
Right.
Yeah, it's their fault.
I think so, too. I mean, we had a situation here and it was like, you know, it wasn't a huge thing. But like one of Henry's friends, he and his girlfriend are friends, very good friends with this guy. And this she's good friends with the girl and he's good friends with the guy. They dated for a period of time and then this other couple broke up. And so there was all this angst around when this other girl was sort of like starting to get interested in another one of their guy friends. It was like, oh, we just feel so bad for the boy. Like he, you know, it's so hard for him to sort of see, you know, she's moved on. He's so heartbroken, whatever. And every time this conversation would happen in front of me, I would be like, here's the thing. This other girl is just living her life. She should not be curtailed from doing the things that just the things that
well,
you do in
your
life.
Were they saying she like, shouldn't do it?
No.
Were they saying she shouldn't have a crush on another boy?
No,
or were they just
they
expressing sympathy
about,
for the boy who had been jilted?
They were talking about changing their plans and like, you know, doing all of this like very teen, like intricate maneuvering so that the boy wouldn't have to see that, you know, the girl was. And I'm like, here's the thing, though, like, it's completely okay for her to continue living her life without having to worry about this thing in the background. Like, they had a relationship. It ended like months ago. It's if he's having a hard time, like that's, you can be his friend and talk to him around that, but do not reinforce this idea that she should change the street she walks down or the party that she goes to, or she shouldn't go to this event, or maybe
were they
you
trying
shouldn't
to make
invite...
her not walk down a street, or were they walking
was,
down a different
sort of,
street themselves?
It was social engineering. Like we want to have this gathering, but we can't. We have to make sure to insulate this boy from the pain of whatever. And I'm like, it got to a point where I was like, what you're doing is basically punishing this young woman for moving on with her life by basically doing all the social engineering, because she's the one carrying the guilt about it. The boy's hurt, but the girls are the ones trying to like assuage everything. And I'm like, it's okay. Like, how are you helping your friend by not just helping him navigate the reality and instead propagating this fantasy that like maybe, you know what I mean? It just felt really sort of reinforced like a lot of these ideas to me that like she should have to go out of her way to not hurt him when they don't even have a relationship anymore. Like it's interesting how you sort of see this stuff play out even in teen relationships. And, you know, it's easy to look at as an adult and sort of say like, you know, that's right. But you really have to think about explaining it in a way that makes sense to them. And it's like, if we really want to protect this boy from being hurt, should she just like never come to school again? Like, how far are you willing to take this?
Was anyone suggesting that though?
No, but even like the small suggestions smacked of that a little bit. And I want to use the term slippery slope. I think that's stupid in a lot of context. It's not. I mean, I think it's also wrong to say like, we shouldn't invite both of them to a thing. I mean, if you don't want to, that's fine, but don't make it under the pretext of like, because she's doing something that will hurt him. She's not doing anything.
No.
She's just living her life.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
And I completely agree that like blaming a girl for not wanting to go out with a boy or not wanting to sleep with a boy or framing the situation as one in which a woman is withholding something from a man when she doesn't want to sleep with him. Obviously, that's horrible and nobody should do that. And we should teach our sons not to do that. And that's terrible. And I agree with that. And then it's also possible, right, for a boy to say, well, it's not her fault that she rejected me and she's not being evil by rejecting me, but also I feel like shit because I keep getting rejected and that feels really bad. And what do you do about that? What do you do about what's underneath the blame or that what's left when you teach them not to blame? What do you do about just the hurt?
I think it's okay to talk about the hurt. That's a real thing. I mean, another thing that I think that adults, the mistake adults make a lot of times is not acknowledging that teen love and teen passion is real. I mean, it's a lot better than adult love and a lot and adult passion in many ways and a lot more real. And I think that learning to talk about those feelings openly, acknowledging that they're real, you know, acknowledging that, you know, this... I mean, how many times have you been like in a huge group of people and like you know that not a single person in that room was for you, right? That's a much easier perspective to have as an adult than you do as a kid, especially when the other kid's pairing off. It's okay to have that real conversation with your kids about how sometimes that is just the reality. Like, it's not happening for you right now and that really hurts. And I get it because I've been there. And talk about it in that way and not be dismissive of the feelings of hurt. But again, reinforce the idea that no one is doing anything to you. I mean, I think that's the really important thing.
I guess I'm saying I think they're both really important.
Well, yeah, but I also think that, too, that we live in a situation where, and again, you're not parenting kids in a vacuum. You're parenting kids in an existing set of expectations and beliefs. And if you do, and like the default setting, I think, is that if you were to just never address the issue with your boy child, let's say, and you were to generally just say like, hey, be a good person, don't mess anything up, be nice to people, etc. And you were to just turn your boy child loose into the world, which is effectively what we do via their social experiences in the world, also via media. And then the older they get, the less time they spend with you, the more time they spend in the world. What would happen if you were to just generally do that as a default is boys would be more likely to believe that their bad feelings were the fault of someone else's shortcoming, and girls would be more likely to believe that their bad feelings were the result of their own shortcomings. And both of those default positions are fucked up. And so we're trying to disrupt and intervene in those default settings. And so for a boy who is experiencing, and this is what I would do, for a boy who's experiencing a difficult feeling of rejection, which is a normal human experience, that's not the problem. The problem is that the default setting for our society is for that boy to believe that that feeling of rejection is the result of someone else letting him down. And so that's where I, so to answer your question, what I do in those conversations is I talk with my kid in a way that is about love and acceptance, where I like try and be as intimate with him as I can, as loving and gentle. And gentle is a really important word for me, with my son especially, as gentle with him as I can be. And I encourage him, first of all, to voice the feeling of loneliness and rejection, because that feeling usually is underneath. That comes after some other thing. I try to give him words for that. But that feeling of loneliness and rejection, that's the layer underneath. Oh, I'm so mad at this person. Or I feel like girls only like these kinds of guys. Why don't they like these kinds of guys? Or like, why don't people understand me? Or like, why is everyone else, right? That's always the default setting. So my job is to help him like peel back the layer on that, to gently challenge. Maybe there's something underneath that. Because underneath most bad behavior is a feeling of isolation, fear, loneliness, and pain. And so part of what I want to do is like, I think a lot of fucking progress gets made if people can just voice that. If they can just honestly voice that that's what's happening, is that I'm feeling lonely. Not that other people are abandoning me. I think what, you know what I mean? And so my job is to like make a safe, sort of gentle, quiet, soft enough space in these conversations with my son that he can voice those things and that he can know that those things are okay. It's okay that you feel lonely. It's normal. It's okay that you feel isolated. It's normal. And here's some of the ways that I felt that way as a child, and that's okay. And also the second thing I try to communicate is that just because that's the case doesn't mean it has to change. You're not owed some immediate solution to that problem. You might just have to sit with the feeling of loneliness for a little bit of time, and that's okay. And that feeling of loneliness isn't necessarily reflective of the fact that you are alone. A lot of that has to do with it's just the way the human mind works. We just think that we're lonely even when we're surrounded by people. That's just what we do sometimes. And that's okay. And I still love you. And would you like to go out for some pizza? And tell me about a movie that you saw. Or do you need some time alone? Or do you just want to play a video game? And it's us giving space for people to voice those feelings and gently guiding them to have the language to voice those actual feelings that I think is a key way of disrupting the default setting, which is to blame other people and then kind of launch into hurtful behavior.
All right. Thanks for that.
I want to go back in time and give teenage Gabe and Carvel a hug. And teenage Rebecca. That's pretty fucking lonely, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's
all coming
up. A bunch of misfits on this fucking podcast.
All coming up.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners. It's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambi Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, time to take a question from a listener. This one came up on our Facebook group. If you're not a member, go to Facebook, search for Slate Parenting, mash that join button. This question is being read by me, Gabe. We have two sons, ages 7 and 5. The 7-year-old was a colicky baby and turned into a toddler who had more than 1-hour-long tantrums at least twice a day for over a year. We took him to counselors who all said he was too young to be evaluated and that he would likely grow out of it. For the most part, he has, but he melts down when he is at either grandparent's house. He's also still quite sensitive and grumpy. On the other hand, our 5-year-old is happy, flexible, and just easygoing. That makes it harder for the 7-year-old because people are naturally drawn to his brother. there is some favoritism, I think, at the grandparents' houses. I've talked to them about it, but it is a bit of a self-perpetuating issue because he is grumpy, the grandparents don't engage with him as much, and then he melts down. I guess I'm looking for advice and wondering if this is something I could have an honest conversation with him about. I communicate quite openly with him and have wondered whether it might help for me to explain why he feels that the grandparents might be more drawn to his brother. But I don't want to make things worse. Help.
She's describing my kids. This is exactly what my kids were like when they were little. 3 and 5, 5 and 7, 8 and 10. Henry was the worst, and he was so crabby all the time, and Teddy was so easy. And, you know, it's a solid bet that your older, sensitive son, who, you know, is more perceived as more difficult, has more meltdowns because he has high expectations of the world, is going to turn out to be like a super chill older kid. I don't think you should talk to him about the fact that people like his brother more than they like him. I don't think that that's okay. I don't think that that's going to lead anywhere necessarily positive. This is something, you know, it's tricky. And if he is, it's difficult to sort of unravel exactly why you say he's melting down at the grandparents. You sort of intimate that he's melting down because he's not getting as much attention from the grandparents. I'm not sure if that's exactly the case, but that's certainly your perception of it. I think it's really important to continue having the conversation with the grandparents that, yes, I know that younger boy is easier, more easygoing, more flexible, but, you know, it's really important to not telegraph to the older one who's still just 7 that he sucks. You know, maybe that's not helping. there's no easy solution here, but personalities are what they are. There is probably nothing wrong with your son. He's finally attuned to the injustices of the world, and that's going to make him an awesome person. And your younger son, who's super easygoing, will probably end up in high school and never do his homework, just like my younger son. So you might have a pendulum. So I'm not saying that's going to happen. That was just a joke. But I don't know. You kind of have to ride this one out. And I think just really be honest with the grandparents about the disparity in attention and what you observe, and not make it the kid's fault. Because you're not talking about what he's doing. You're talking about who he is. And I think it's important to think of it that way. This is who he is. It's not what he's doing. And I can't think of anything worse than going up to somebody and sort of implying, like, listen, it's who you are that makes people not want to hang out with
totally.
You.
Totally. Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't think you should talk about this with the kids at all. You should talk about with his grandparents a lot. Talk about this with the grandparents a lot. They need to manage and control their own biases with relationship to these kids. That is your oldest needs that. And it's their responsibility to start working on that. And I think you need to help them see that they need to do that and help them figure out how to do that. I don't think you need to get the kid involved at all in this, other than to continue to provide the unconditional love and support that we as parents are responsible for, given the fact that the rest of the world is going to be pretty conditional in their love and support. We would like our kids to have one sort of bedrock place where they feel like, you know, they can know that they're loved, and they don't have to constantly be earning their love by performing a particular way. I think we want our kids to not feel that way. I think there's a lot of places both in the world and even within our families that reinforce the belief that we have to perform a particular kind of thing in order to be loved, and without that, we're not loved. And I think that parents, one of the jobs of parents is to be at least, you know, as much of a solid home base as you can. And I think that your 7-year-old sounds like someone who needs that. And so I don't think I would go to him and say, hey, people don't like you because you're weird and you're just going to have to get used to it. I think you should say, I love you and you're great. And sometimes people, you know, aren't as nice as they should be, but that's okay. And I love you. And but I think you should pull the grandparents aside and say, hey, look, I know that the older one was really tough as a baby and the younger one is really chill, but the older one is really starting to feel like you kind of like prefer the younger, and maybe you do, and that's your business if you do, but can you keep an eye on that? Cause I don't want him feeling like an outcast in his own family.
Yeah. I think, like, there's a name for the, like, what this parent wants is for their kid to see a sort of feedback loop between their behavior and the response they get, right? Mm-hmm, like the parent sees, mm-hmm, like, hey, when you throw a fit like that about nothing, then it's off-putting to people, and then people aren't nice to you, and that's making you unhappy. And if you could just perceive that, then maybe you would not throw the fit, because then you would get a better result and you would have a positive feedback loop instead of this kind of negative feedback loop. There is a word for the time when you start to realize that the things that you do affect the way people respond to you, and that word is adolescence. Like, adolescence is when you start to realize, oh shit, I need to completely change my entire personality in order to get what I want out of the world. And you can't push a 7-year-old into adolescence. It'll come in its own good time, and until then you have to just let him be a 7-year-old, and you'll miss that 7-year-old when he's an incredibly self-conscious teenager trying to figure out how to, like, get girls to like him and using phrases like friend zone or whatever. You'll be like, it was better when he was a completely unselfconscious 7-year-old who would just melt down in the middle of his grandparents' living room while everybody kind of sighed and gave his brother lots of cookies and stuff. Good luck with it, but I think Carvel's right. You got to deal with this as parents and as grandparents, and you can't expect a 7-year-old to take responsibility for stuff like that. It's time for the part of the show that we sometimes call recommendations and at other times call recommendations. Carvel, what do you recommend?
Inspired by Rebecca's recommendation last week of a dog video, I'm going to recommend a dog video that I don't know what to call it. I'm just going to forward it to you guys, and then it'll be on the page, and we'll link to it. It's a video of a dog in a wheelchair going outside to play.
Oh,
that's all I have
that
to say
video.
About it. You've seen it, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I cried. I had fucking cried real fucking tears the whole time I was watching that shit. It was just too much. So, yeah, I'm going to recommend that. Everyone should go cry.
I'm going to recommend something that has solved a problem that we have had with Leo since the beginning of time. One of the things with Leo is, you know how kids like identify certain things as like kid things and like, that's for me. And if it's not a kid thing, then it's a grown up thing and it's boring and stupid. Leo is like the epitome of that. Like, he will not listen to grown up music. That's the real sticking point, is that any music, even like very nice, unchallenging music, rockin', exciting music, whatever kind of music, if he doesn't identify it as like, this is kid music, then he doesn't want it. And so we sometimes have to, like, when we're in the car, we wind up like, we take turns. I'll play a song, you play a song, you play a song, you play a song. And then he like complains during the grown-up songs. And then he gets to hear the like Teen Titans Go theme song or whatever. But recently, there was one song that I've been playing on these road trips, partly because it's a great song and partly because it's like 7 minutes long. So it's like six times as long as the Teen Titans Go theme song. And he doesn't quite realize that we're listening to my music way more than his music, because my song is 6 minutes long. But so he's heard this song quite a lot. And then the other day in the house, I caught him singing the chorus. Like, he was just walking around singing the chorus of a grown-up song. And I was like, are you singing? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, it's a good song, isn't it? And he was like, yeah, it is. He admitted that it was. So I'm going to recommend the song Drunk Driver's Killer Whales by the band Car Seat Headrest, because, man, is it a great song, and it's so great that it even sold my 4-year-old on how great it was. There will be a link on all the usual places. Rebecca, how about you? What do you recommend?
You're underscoring the advice I give people all the time, which is to never introduce your kids to kids' music to begin with, ever. Like, I never introduced my kids to it, and it's the greatest decision I ever made, because whenever I hear kids' music, I want to shoot myself in the face.
I don't know. I got really into the Moana soundtrack for a while. Like I really like the Moana and the Little Mermaid soundtrack. There's some good stuff.
But that's just adults. That's adult music sung by cartoon characters. It's not really kids' music.
I know, but he'll accept it.
Okay. I'm going to recommend a very urgent Instagram account that my son Henry made me aware of about a month ago and that I am completely addicted to. It was one I followed anyway, but the recent developments have been very important and everyone should be aware of them, both children and adults alike. Jonathan Van Ness from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Gay of Thrones and the Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness podcast is learning how to figure skate. And he is posting daily updates from his ice skating lessons on his Instagram. And it is the most beautiful series of videos with these, like, really inspirational, corny but inspirational in the way that he always is, messages about trying things and failing and succeeding. And he's actually getting, like, kind of good, like in good in a way that like an adult learning ice skating, like you'd be amazed that, you know, you could even think about getting good at this super hard thing. But it's really been fun to watch. And every day, you know, we kind of get together at dinner and like watch the latest JVN uploaded ice skating video together. And we're really enjoying watching his progress. And it's a really fun activity for us as a family. And I just can't recommend it enough. So I'll pass the link along so we can be posted in case you're not on Instagram. If you are on Instagram, just look for at JVN and you will get to see all the videos that I'm talking about.
I just want to jump in here and issue one warning. He's probably not in his 40s, which means that like those of us that are in our 40s, if he falls...
his bones will heal.
He's also like a yoga master.
Bedridden for 300 years. So
just, he's also like a yoga master and a former cheerleader and has like a lot of gymnastic skill, which, you know, yeah, we don't have. So that's why it's fun watching him learn.
Moms and dads, that's the don't key. Try this at home.
Do not.
All right, that's our show. If you have a question that you want us to tackle, you can call us 424-255-7833. Alternately, you can email us at the email address momanddad@slate.com. You can tell us what you thought of the show at our Facebook group. Go on Facebook and search for Slate Parenting. Our show is produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie, I'm Gabriel Roth. Thanks so much for a great 2018. We will see you in the new year.